The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Depending on your perspective, publishing a book on Christian republicanism the same year that a Republican of decidedly Christian convictions was reelected President of the United States is either incredibly fortuitous or remarkably jinxed. The good reasons for the coincidence of America's God and W's second term are mainly financial. The churchgoers who turned out in overwhelming numbers to reelect President Bush, upon hearing that Mark A. Knoll, designated by Time magazine as evangelicalism's intellectual exemplar, has recently written a book on Christian republicanism, arguably his most important, might buy enough copies to give a university press book a trade press rate of sale. The bad reasons for the timings is that those not particularly enamored of the Christian Republican in the White House, the folks, mind you, who buy university press books, will ignore a book about Christian republicanism without ever recognizing that the small r republicanism of the Revolutionary era is a different animal from the capital R republicanism of today's Protestant right. To see that 18th and 21st century republicanism are two different types of political philosophy, readers need only compare Knoll's definition of the older kind against the ideas that President Bush has used to secure the hegemony of the GOP. To be sure, as Knoll concedes, late 18th century republicanism was a many-splendored thing that the founding fathers used to signify everything from the rule of law in Adams and the prohibition of titles of nobility in Hamilton to universal public education advocated by Jefferson and policies to promote the public interest, as in Thomas Paine's thought. But underneath the laundry list of republicanism's components or consequences emerge a set of convictions that make the contemporary United States look like a polity in search of an identity. According to Knoll, the old republicanism consisted of a series of contrasts that stressed limited government and personal virtue. This outlook pitted illegitimate authority against freedom, divine right monarchies against autonomous local communities, established versus voluntary religion, corruption against vice, the country against the court, and slavery against autonomy or personal freedom. In sum, quoting Knoll, to preserve freedom, especially the freedom to control one's own property, the leaders of the state, as well as citizens with access to public power, had to conduct themselves and their affairs in a manner congenial to the public spirit. In contrast, Knoll adds, if power were allowed to accumulate without check, if competition for power encouraged factions to promote their private interests, or if a love of luxury supplanted the exercise of public-spirited service, then corruption followed inevitably. Although many of these themes continue to inform the ideas of the current president, they have a quaint sound in the light of contemporary reality, such as the seemingly arbitrary power of the United States to topple Arab dictators, the consolidation of money and influence inside the nation's capital, the existence of political clans like the Bushes and the Kennedys that have the verisimilitude of nobility, and the vice-producing consequences of luxury and privilege readily on display in the Bush daughters. To be sure, some of the blame here may go to the first Republican president, the venerable Abe Lincoln, who, by preserving the Union, ensured that the United States would leave behind Jefferson's vision of an agrarian republic and become instead a capitalist society in which, according to Alan Gelzo, cash, merchandising, and markets could open up vast new personal alternatives to the agrarian economy and even transform the agrarian economy itself into a competitive mobile enterprise. In other words, Lincoln, an ambiguously Christian capital R Republican, by making markets rather than the land the prime factor in social and economic relationships, paved the way for the current Christian Republican. Still, even if Bush does not bear complete responsibility for the GOP's revision of republicanism, he is useful for showing how distant the older form is from its contemporary namesake. Yet despite the obvious differences, upon closer inspection, 21st century Christian republicanism may be a legitimate as opposed to bastard child of the 18th century ancestor. One of the points that Noel makes exceedingly well in this book is that the 18th century Protestants who embraced republicanism did so in a manner that baptized the nation that in 1776 declared its independence from England. He writes that in this compound of Christian republicanism, theologians translated the historic Christian message into the dominant cultural languages of politics and intellectual life so successfully that these languages were themselves converted and then enlisted for the decidedly religious purposes of evangelism, church formation, moral reform, and theological construction. But Noel adds that the price of this success may have been too high. The key moves in the creation of evangelical America were also the key moves that created secular America. That's a quote. If in a great surge of evangelization and moral reform, American Protestants almost converted the nation, so too did the nation mold the Christian gospel in the contours of its own shape. Again, that's a quotation. Thus, the unintended, Noel calls it tragic as opposed to ironic, the unintended consequence of Christian cultural accommodation was to create a religious and political culture in which evangelical Protestants still show, especially when the White House is up for grabs, all the signs of cultural captivity. Just as the older Christian Republicans confused the demands of faithfulness with the duties of patriotism, so contemporary born-again Republicans believe that the fortunes of the gospel depend upon the superpower of the United States. To be clear, Noel's concern in America's God is, as the title indicates, with theology, not with politics. He specifically attempts to trace in a sophisticated and nuanced way the influence that the second word in the phrase Christian republicanism had upon the first. In other words, how republicanism revised Christianity. I should add here that Noel is explicit in denying that this narrative is one of declension. But despite this denial, the book clearly reads like a story of failure. From Noel's own stated preference for Jonathan Edwards' theology, his demonstration of how republicanism defanged the genius of Edwards' theology, to his concluding the book with the debacle of the Civil War and contemporary theologians' inability to prevent or comprehend the war's significance. Reading the book has the clear, even if subtle, feeling of going downhill. As such, a responsible inference from America's God is that Christian theology suffered under the liberation granted by republicanism. On the credit side, Noel concludes, to be sure, American religious leaders in the early 19th century still professed much that earlier theologians also held. Almost all still maintained that humans were sinners in need of salvation, and they continued with only isolated exceptions like Ralph Waldo Emerson to think that salvation was provided by God and Jesus Christ. But on the debit side comes the following. Yet they were much more likely than before to hold that the human will was an active, necessary, and determinative participant in the reception of divine grace, that the human mind played a decisive role in determining the reality of both natural and supernatural phenomena, and that the personal apprehension and action were more important than traditional, mediated, or historic authorities in determining the nature of the Christian truth. For any Augustinian worth his salt, America's God is a story of declension. What I would like to highlight in my remaining time is not what Christian republicanism did to Christian theology, but instead to American politics. With considerable effect, Noel cites the observations that Dietrich Bonhoeffer made during his travels in the United States during the 1930s to show the damage that Christian republicanism did to theology and church life in America. Instead of regarding the amalgamation of freedom and Christianity as a blessing of Christian America, Bonhoeffer actually saw it as a threat to the church's well-being. He wrote, "The freedom of the church is not where it has possibilities, but only where the gospel really and in its own power makes room for itself on earth, even and precisely when no such possibilities are offered to it." Consequently, the freedom that American Protestants advocated, thanks to the legacy of Christian republicanism, was prone to become secularized more quickly than a church which does not possess freedom or possibility. This paradoxical dynamic in which the adaptation of the gospel to American politics yielded both the Christianization of the United States and the secularization of the church. And this is key to Noel's assessment of American theology under Christian republicanism's influence. Bonhoeffer's observations are also useful, however, for noticing the effects of Christian republicanism on American political thought. Bonhoeffer believed that because the American Revolution derived a bedrock conviction about human sinfulness from Puritanism, the American political order took as axiomatic the idea that the kingdom of God on earth cannot be built by the state, but only by the community of Jesus Christ. In turn, this notion gave the church in the American setting clear preeminence over the state. As such, the church proclaims the principles of social and political order. The state merely provides the technical means of putting them into effect. This understanding of religion and politics was, for Bonhoeffer, a break with the Protestant Reformation's distinction between the two offices or the two realms, which will remain ordained by God until the end of the world, each with its own duty fundamentally different from the other, according to Bonhoeffer. The implication of this point was that political philosophy in the United States remained underdeveloped thanks to the heavy hand of Christian theology, even of Republican vintage. Politics was merely a subset of religious reflection rather than a category of thought with its own rights and prerogatives, just as the state's jurisdiction is independent from church power. Perhaps it is unfair to use a work of religious history to establish Bonhoeffer's point about the stunted character of American political thought, but America's God does display here and there the signs of the weakness the German pastor observed. For instance, Knoll is decidedly ambivalent about republicanism's compatibility with Christian orthodoxy. On one level, he shows that republicanism as a form of ordering society prior to the 18th century was generally embraced by the heterodox or worse and rejected by the orthodox. Knoll argues that the reformers were not nursemaids of liberty and even believed in the necessity of coercion to enforce religious conformity. The same is the case for the Puritans. Knoll writes that when they remained committed to traditional Christian ideas of human depravity, the sovereignty of divine grace, and the need for a revelation from God, they also remained antagonistic to Republican ideas. At another level, his narrative implies that the rise of Republicanism in the 18th century brought with it the collapse of the Puritan canopy. Knoll sums up the incompatibility of Christianity with Republicanism in the following manner, and here I quote, "Republican instincts prized human self-sufficiency more highly than dependence upon God. They demanded the life to come by focusing without reservation on this worldly existence. They defined the human good in terms of public usefulness instead of divine approval. The discourse of virtue, vice, liberty, and tyranny seemed always to be associated with the rejection of innate human sinfulness, with views on human salvation that dispensed with the substitutionary work of Christ, with opinions about Jesus treating him as no more than an unusual human being, and in the most extreme cases, with arguments denying the existence of God altogether." End of quote. Nasty stuff, that republicanism. Of course, Knoll may claim, like Jack Webb, to be reporting just the facts, ma'am, but he also refrains from commenting that these Christian interpretations of republicanism might have been wrong. For instance, the alternative system of government, that of monarchy, is no more compatible with the doctrine of original sin than republicanism, because to invest a sinful person with all that power is as much a recipe for social chaos as a system of checks and balances. But aside from the merits of either monarchies or republics, is a more basic question of whether Christianity involves any orthodox theory of politics. Although Knoll is critical of what he labels a reformed literal hermeneutic because it could be wooden and simplistic, his own presentation suggests at times an agreement with the notion that special revelation, the part that reveals Christ, has as much to say about this worldly realities like the ordering of society and delegation of political power. For example, he observes that the reformed, this is before the decline, the reformed commitment to theological significance of everyday life led to the development of something like Protestant metaphysics, Protestant epistemology, Protestant science, Protestant politics, Protestant social and economic theory, Protestant art, and even Protestant poetics. Abraham Kuyper could not have written it better. Knoll adds that wherever sufficient reformed strength existed, the assumption also existed that biblical Christianity had something fairly definite to say about everything. This helps to explain why the rise of republicanism could be viewed as a departure from Protestant norms, which is the impression that America's God definitely conveys, since this theory of politics assumed religion had little to say about the affairs of state. Knoll concedes that the reformed outlook could end up in secularization and produce large amounts of pride, but overall he does not present the reformed cultural basis from which Christian republicanism departed in a negative light. As Sir Thomas More had it, silence of such kind could be read as consent. I should add that sometimes Knowles' implicit agreement with pre-Republican Protestant politics can be confusing, such as is in his assessment of Jonathan Edwards. On the one hand, Edwards is Knowles' theological North Star. But America's God also reveals in Edwards, and Edwards who, by raising the bar for church membership in Northampton, weakened the Puritan notion of covenanted community that fused the religious and political into an organic whole. As such, Knowles concedes that Edwards created an intellectual vacuum that Christian republicanism attempted to fill. In Knowles' own words, the colonial theologian dismembered the Puritan concept of covenant and so opened thought to a subtle yet powerful move from theology to politics and intellectual leadership to a shift from the clergy to men of state. The tone here is not one of sackcloth and ashes, but it does have a hint of sadness and regret, suggesting again Knowles' ambivalence about Christian republicanism because its politics are at odds with forms of government more compatible with Christian orthodoxy. One piece of evidence that Knowles does not use to support his contention about the effects of Christian republicanism on theology is one of the least studied confessional revisions in American Presbyterian history. In 1787, Presbyterian Synod appointed a committee to bring the Westminster Confession, an Erastian state-approved document, into conformity with the new political realities of the United States, which required no profession of faith for holding federal office. Time does not permit a detailed summary of the Westminster Assembly's older assertions about the civil magistrate that their American heirs either deleted or changed. Perhaps one example will have to suffice. The original Westminster Confession in Chapter 23, Article 3, affirmed civil magistrates' authority not to administer the word and sacraments, but to call synods, to be present at them, and to provide that whatsoever is transacted in them be according to the word of God. The American revision of this article referred to civil magistrates as nursing fathers who had a duty to protect the church without giving any preference to any denomination of Christians. The American revisions added that the following hedge on state power: it is the duty of civil magistrates to protect the person and good name of all their people in such an effectual manner as that no person be suffered either upon pretense of religion or infidelity to offer any indignity, violence, abuse, or injury to any other person whatsoever. So American Presbyterians not only lopped off the magistrate's authority in church life, but also stipulated that the state had the duty to protect religious freedom and the religious pluralism that would naturally ensue. Of course, the American revision of the Westminster Confession could be construed as yet another expression of the church's capitulation to republicanism. It could also be considered a return to church-state arrangements before Constantine. In either case, the point worth considering is that the revision did not alter in the slightest the confession's doctrinal system of 17th century Calvinism. In the minds of its revisers, that system may have been in flux, but changing the confession's politics did not require an alteration of its other teachings. In fact, both the Presbyterian Church in America and the Orthodox Presbyterian Church continued to be satisfied with this revision, even though they rejected 20th century tinkering by the Northern and Southern mainline churches, and even though they may not care for religious pluralism. Which leaves us with the question, if after embracing republicanism, it is possible still to believe in original sin and limited atonement or even double predestination, why does America's God render republicanism as incompatible with Orthodox Christianity? Or to ask this question with a Bonhoefferian accent, but I won't really try a German one. Could it be that to regard the secularization of American politics as a departure from historic Christianity is to hold that the church provides the principles of social and political order while the state merely provides the technical means of putting them into effect? These questions are not designed to deny that the new political order of the United States, unabashedly expressed as novos ordo seclorum, were without important consequences for American Protestant theology. I raise them only to draw attention to Bonhoeffer's insight that the consequences of a Christian republicanism may have been more damaging to American politics by perpetuating the belief that theologians have much to teach political philosophers. Consequently, if confusion about Christian republicanism leads more Republican Christians to read America's God and think harder about the relationship between faith and politics, then the timing of Knowles' book may not only be fortuitous but merciful.
Appreciate this opportunity to comment on Dr. Noel's volume, America's God, and I appreciate Daryl's comments as focusing on a number of the political implications, and I will take us in a very different direction, well, not a very different direction, but a different direction by looking at some of the theological implications that I think this book draws. But first, let me say that Dr. Mark Noel's latest book, America's God, has given the scholar and student of American religious history a splendid example of penetrating research and erudite writing. America's God demonstrates how the methods and resources of social, political, and theological histories combine to construct a compelling narrative of the intellectual thought of 18th and 19th century America. Contrary to much of what social and political historians have concluded, theology does matter. And Dr. Noel has given us a contextual account of the meaning and place of theology, which shaped ideas and events during the crucial period when this nation was formed. For this, Dr. Noel should be applauded. Beyond the general comments, America's God provides the historical details which aid us in understanding a unique American theological trajectory. Noel gives convincing evidence for a significant theological shift as colonial ministers and theologians wrestled with the challenges of Enlightenment philosophies and the impending political confrontation with England. The collapse of the Puritan canopy, as Noel describes, with Jonathan Edwards as a transitional figure, illustrates the historical shift that introduced a new theological direction. The skepticism of the Enlightenment produced numerous responses from European and North American Christians in defense of the faith once delivered. In Germany, the Kantian response led to a liberal tradition with a radical separation between that which was considered physical from the metaphysical. While in America, the response of common sense realism produced a new theological tradition, which was clearly different from the Protestant, or more specifically, Reformed theology of the 17th century, as transmitted by 17th century Puritans to North America, as well as being influenced by continental Reformed theologians. At this point, the benefit of Noel's earlier work on the influence of common sense realism at Princeton University and the theology of Old Princeton Seminary is most helpful. Yet, Noel asserts that it was the convergence of this common sense philosophy and political republicanism that gave birth to a new American theology. The intellectual tools were now in place to respond to Enlightenment skepticism, to justify the growing dissatisfaction with colonial rule, and to articulate a specific American Christianity. Now, for the remainder of my discussion here, I want to focus on two aspects of America's God that I think address a number of the issues that we would be concerned with, particularly in a Reformed Presbyterian context here. First of all, I'd like to focus on that the intellectual context that Noel presents for us helps to explain some of the anomalies in the history of American Reformed Presbyterian theology, particularly the synthesis of common sense philosophy in the theology of Old Princeton. While maintaining a robust Reformed confessionalism, Charles Hodge and B.B. Warfield were children of their times, and the marks of common sense philosophy can be traced in their writings. One could argue that the influence of this moral philosophy resulted in, quote, an inconsistent Calvinism, end quote, that at certain points elevated human rational faculties. One example that I could point out is seen in the discussion of theological prolegomena. 17th century Reformed scholastics like Franciscus Junius, Johannes Caxias, and Francis Turretin maintain a specific distinction that carefully understood the place of human knowledge in relation to God and the epistemological implications of this for the regenerate and unregenerate. These theologians of the 17th century concluded that all knowledge was revealed by God as an ectype of God's archetypal theology, and this revealed knowledge took the form of either special or general revelation. Likewise, this could only be understood correctly by the regenerate. The unregenerate, while still possessing rational faculties, ultimately produced only teologia falsa, what they described as false theology. The 17th century's approach to prolegomena is absent in the systematic theologies written by the luminaries of Old Princeton. Their departure marked a shift in the Reformed tradition, which could be seen as a small step towards rationalism. I say that very carefully. This was not the Reformed tradition codified by the 17th century, but an original modification of that Calvinism. Again, Old Princeton could not step outside of their context, the fall of the Puritan canopy, and the pervasive influence of common sense philosophy. If this is the case, why is it that theologians like Hodge and Warfield, in fact, do not see themselves in contradiction with the tradition previously received? Is this theological self-awareness so conditioned by their context that they were unable to see their own modifications, or were they consciously departing from their Reformed predecessors? I ask that and leave that first. Second, America's God identifies the historical roots of a number of modern evangelical characteristics. Some of the characteristics of modern evangelicalism include an individualistic, rationalistic, autonomous understanding of Christianity, established by what Dr. Knowles described as a literal hermeneutic. Of course, some are now proclaiming the erosion of these characteristics in light of postmodernism. The emergence, forgive the pun, of evangelical leaders calling for a new kind of Christianity, which emphasizes things like the missional calling of the church, the communal or corporate aspects of faith, and elements of spiritual formation over against the purely rational approaches, are all reactions to evangelicalism, claiming that evangelicalism is ill-equipped to survive the radical changes brought on by postmodernism. Is the response of the Reformed community, in light of this history, to embrace these new trends or to return to an old-school Presbyterianism of the 19th century, or do we have another option? Should we then look for resources located in a Protestant evangelicalism with pre-modern roots and the accompanying confessions and creed, not born from the womb of modern foundationalism, but from an era which began with the Principia Incendi, the first principle of God himself? These are questions that I leave open and continue to ask myself.
The title of my remarks are The God That Failed. To those of a certain age, The God That Failed was a collection of remembrances by ex-communists that was published in the 1940s and 50s. And I think it's a particularly apt, it might even have been a subtitle, from Mark Knowles' book. Of the many lessons a reader might draw from Mark Knowles' America's God, one not immediately obvious is that George W. Bush is neither an aberration nor a novelty in American history. When candidate Bush declared in the 2000 presidential primaries that Jesus Christ was his, quote, favorite political philosopher, many intellectuals, especially liberals, either recoiled in fear or snorted in derision, and not at the category mistake. Here, surely, was a declaration of war on tolerance, a dim-witted but sinister assault on the separation of church and state. If Bush were elected, so the argument portended, the White House would be inundated with evangelical loons as fierce and mangy as sagebrush from Lubbock. I've never been to Lubbock, so I don't know. I just like the name. While the fear and derision might not have abated if Knoll had published his book a couple of years earlier, the historical illiteracy of thinking Bush a total goofball could have been exposed and discredited. I say that as an Augustinian Catholic and a socialist, who has neither an aversion to the public use of religious language, nor much of a fondness for the Protestant Republican tradition, of which Bush's remark was an etiolated example. My twofold identification is germane to my remarks, because both traditions mediated my reaction to Knoll's grand and lucid exposition of the trajectory of American Protestantism up to the Civil War. As an Augustinian Catholic, I consider Knoll's account of how Augustine faded from the theological and political imagination of American Protestantism to be the crucial element of the tale. And as a socialist, I think that Knoll's relative inattention to the political and moral economy of proprietary capitalism serves to obscure two problems. One, the question posed by Max Weber a century ago of whether or not there is an inexorably capitalist trajectory to Protestant religious culture. And two, the persistence of the Protestant Republican tradition in an especially imperialist form. Both of these problems have a high degree of visibility in the Bush presidency. And so I'd like to suggest that America's God is not only a superlative piece of cultural and intellectual history, but also a book that is urgently relevant to any critical assessment of our contemporary political culture. As a work of history, America's God is a magnificent and indispensable success. As a theological entity, America's God was and is a failure, one apparently still in need of our merciless exposure and blasphemy. As other commentators have outlined America's God, I'm not going to rehearse either the main themes or the narrative of the book. I will start by saying, with great respect, that I think Nall is guilty of a bit of false advertising when, in the opening paragraph, he tells us that, quote, Christian theology, not the United States, is the primary concern. That may be true, strictly speaking, but while reading this book, I couldn't help but recall H. Richard Niebuhr's characterization in The Kingdom of God in America of American history as, quote, an experiment in constructive Protestantism. For the dramatist personae in Knowles' play comprise a bulk of the leading characters in American cultural history before 1865. And so while America's God marks the culmination of a generation of research in antebellum religious history, I hope that it does not remain segregated in that disciplinary bailiwick. The procedures and outcomes of that Protestant experiment were determined early on, to return to Nall's interpretive scheme, by the atrophy, if not quite the disappearance, of the Augustinian Reformed dimensions in Protestant theology and the evangelical embrace of Scottish common sense epistemology and moral philosophy as a kind of surrogate for Augustinian and Reformed perspectivalism. Both Augustinian and Reformed theologies are avowedly confessional and perspectival. They hold that sinful creatures require grace to discern truths about God, virtue, and society. These theological orientations obviously minimize the intellectual and moral potential that small r Republican political thought, to which I'll get in a moment, considers essential for self-government. They also set the stage for ecclesiologies that defined the church as an all-encompassing community, one charged with guardianship of all spheres of human life by draping over the earthly city what Nall describes as, quote, a Puritan canopy, that Puritan covenant theology so memorably described by Perry Miller. The attrition or abandonment of this theology, and especially of this ecclesiology, over the course of the 18th and early 19th centuries is the key moment in the tale. And here the tremendously ambivalent actor is Jonathan Edwards, whom Nall explicitly calls his, quote, benchmark against which to measure theological change. Now, like all revolutionaries, Edwards looked both backwards and forwards. On the one hand, he affirmed the Augustinian idea that virtue required supernatural assistance, and thus a particular perspective. Yet he also argued for a drastic ecclesiological minimalism, which, by paring ecclesiology down to, quote, the converted individual and the church, spelled, quote, the collapse of the Puritan canopy, or in other words, the dissolution of that older Puritan covenant theology. At roughly the same time, Protestant divines were beginning to embrace common sense philosophy, associated with Hutchison, Reed, Smith, and Ferguson. Edwards' reduction of ecclesiology is crucial here, for if the church's perspective can achieve social relevance only within the bond between the individual and the church, how can one define a cultural and political order with the unregenerate? The answer increasingly was by emphasizing common sense and self-evident truths. Now, common sense, along with its cousins, practical and pragmatic, are often words which I think signal some prejudice about to be expressed, or some infamy about to be perpetrated. You don't have to be some knowing, languid postmodernist to suggest that common sense carries an enormous burden of ideological baggage, to wit, the long and still robust tradition of anti-intellectualism, whose story Richard Hofstadter has told so well, the plain speech tradition, with its facile confidence in the representational transparency of language, economic practicality, which defines reason in almost wholly pecuniary terms, an indifference to aesthetic beauty or merit, which expresses itself in such mundane miserliness as the cutting of music and arts budgets. The problem so often with common sense is that it's all too common and not enough sense. This new exaltation of common sense, together with the retreat of classical Augustinian and Reformed theology, enabled a swift and combustible amalgamation of Christian theology and Republican political thought in Christian Republicanism. This fusion should, I think, be termed the American Covenant theology, filio-pietist heir to Puritan covenant theology, the basis for G.K. Chesterton's famous remark that America was, quote, a nation with the soul of a church. Nall comes close to using this term at a couple of points, but he never actually uses it. I think it's worth recalling here that Chesterton was not sure if he should be amused or appalled by this fusion. And I detect a similar ambivalence in Nall. On the one hand, Christian republicanism affirmed the capacities of ordinary people in a way which I think only the most incorrigibly snobbish and self-serving could dismiss. Whatever form of demurals they may use, I don't really want power, etc., those who profess to believe in rule by the wise or by, this is a great phrase, genuine aristocracy, are always almost always assuming the plenitude and munificence of their own wisdom. Witness the ignoble Straussian cabal now quartered in the White House. And yet, on the other hand, Nall himself observes, tersely but uneasily, that under the canopy of Christian republicanism, quote, political values altered the substance of religion. That's a mild but still salutary caution these days. But I want to elicit its full force, not by retracing the history that Nall relates so well, but by posing a provocation that will surely trouble those admirers of Lincoln, as disparate as Nall and John Patrick Diggins. The cadence and lyrical gravity of Lincoln's second inaugural address has so mesmerized generations of readers that it has preempted what I consider to be an unavoidable question. Is the modern nation state, or what Philip Bobbitt has recently called the modern market state, capable of the discernment and magnanimity envisioned in that oration? Quote, for Lincoln, Nall writes, the course of the war injected a doubt about whether America was the people of God. For Lincoln is the crucial limiting phrase there. For I see little evidence that Americans have ever entertained such qualms for long. Lincoln's sort of reminder about the inscrutability of divine purpose is usually about as efficacious as the just war tradition, which has never, to my knowledge, prevented a single act of carnage deemed necessary by the state. And why has neither source of admonition ever been effective? One of the main reasons, I would submit, is the investiture of the American democratic nation state with ecclesial significance, achieved under the canopy of Christian republicanism. Because Nall focuses almost exclusively on the political dimensions of Christian republicanism, he largely neglects an equally salient feature of that covenant theology, American economic culture and thought. This is a bit surprising, as Nall is the editor of God and Mammon, a recent and indispensable collection of articles on Protestants and antebellum economic life, which I recommend highly. America's God features barely 4 pages on the subject, and we get only a paragraph on Francis Wayland. Yet early national economic thought was marinated in evangelical theology. Wayland's, of course, but also that of Henry Carey, whom Marx himself dubbed, quote, the only original mind among the North American economists. Yet while Nall devotes an entire and entirely absorbing chapter to the Protestant imbroglio over slavery, he doesn't mention the related debate over free labor or wage slavery that historians from Eric Foner to David Roediger have demonstrated was central to the nation's politics and culture, especially after the Mexican War. There's also a great deal about the beguiling and appalling missionary zeal of American capitalism that could have been illuminated by attention to evangelical economics. How else can we appreciate a Russell Conwell or a Bruce Barton? Or take, for instance, the ownership society envisioned by President Bush. What is this but an attempt to recapture the Protestant proprietary dispensation on the unlikely basis of a global corporate economy? And when we consider its international dimensions, might it be more apt to replace the term Christian republicanism with Protestant proprietary imperialism? When President Bush proclaims yet again that freedom is on the march, he's not merely reciting the duplicitous palaver of saber-rattling Straussians. He's echoing the Christian republicanism born of the Revolution. A covenant theology which has shaped, I would say warped, the minds of Americans and not only evangelicals for the entire course of our national history. Think here of Julia Ward Howe exhorting her compatriots, as he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. What a trail of mischief and savagery that sentiment has produced. To put it more pointedly, American imperialist ambition and practice can be traced in large but not exclusive measure to the Christian republicanism that Nall describes so well and so ambivalently. Christian republicanism was the halo and the fuel for notions of manifest destiny, which do not appear in Nall's book, but which, in the 19th century, were lathered in the language of Christian Lebensraum. Ask any Cherokee, or for that matter, any Filipino, Cuban, Vietnamese, or Iraqi. Recall that Republicans held to the principle that property ownership was indispensable to full citizenship. This property, before and for quite some time after the Civil War, could be obtained and protected only by dispossessing the original inhabitants of North America. Christian republicanism sanctioned the westward expansion and displacement, which we should properly understand as the original imperialism of American history. And we should also trace the metamorphosis of antebellum Christian republicanism into the postbellum new imperialism, a la McKinley, who desired, quote, to uplift, civilize, and Christianize the already Catholic Filipinos, into Wilsonian internationalism, and now into its current incarnation in the national security strategy of the United States. Having come to this point, I must pose a few questions to Nall, which challenge him to link his historical scholarship to the current political moment. As he makes clear in his contribution to a recent volume on religion and public life, contemporary political and economic structures cannot win anything but, at best, the most half-hearted and heavily qualified endorsement from Christians. Might he want to use this ambivalence as the springboard for an even broader and perhaps more critical reassessment of Christian republicanism? Might the covenant theology, that is, the synthesis of post-Reformed Protestantism, Republican politics, and capitalist economics, lie at the root of our inability to conceive a common good in anything but either the most procedural or the most moralistic terms? Might it be the root of our imperial expansiveness and myopia, of the well-intentioned and blood-spattered manifest destiny which produces Graham Greene's pile in The Quiet American, of whom, as the wizened Fowler writes, I never knew a man who had better motives for all the trouble he caused. Is America's God the Christian Republican deity, not the book? Is America's God the problem rather than a glory? My suspicion, which I pose as a provocation, is that even to engage these questions, evangelical Protestants would have to disentangle themselves from the Republican political tradition, the common sense epistemological lineage, and the capitalist economic genealogy. But would this not also mean, my Protestant brethren, the reappropriation of Augustine and the Reformers? Recall here Nall's own employment of Edwards as a theological benchmark. Edwards has made several abortive returns in American intellectual history, in H. Richard Niebuhr's Kingdom of God, in Perry Miller's post-war biography, in Christopher Lash's The True and Only Heaven, in George Marsden's recent magnificent biography. In all of these books, Edwards returns as a glorious hound of heaven, and in the final pages of his volume, Nall ventriloquizes the Congregationalist minister Israel Holly. Quote, sir, if I was to engage with you in this controversy, I would say, read Edwards. Let me suggest, though, that the solution to the problems of political theology, as illustrated in and by Christian republicanism, will be found in Augustine. Now, one could argue that Augustine did return to American Protestantism and neo-orthodoxy, and especially in the work of Reinhold and H. Richard Niebuhr, the Brothers Grimm of mid-century Protestant theology. One would be right, I'd concede, but also misleading in two different ways. Take St. Reinhold first, arguably the highest pole star in the liberal firmament since World War II. Encapsulated in his renowned essay, Augustine and Political Realism, Reinhold's Christian realism did indeed appeal to the Bishop of Hippo's unsentimental account of power in the earthly city. And yet I would contend that while Niebuhr rightly read the City of God as a primer in political and social thought, he took Augustine's central conflict between the cities of God and man, between, that is, two kinds of social order, and recast it as a struggle between two kinds of personal orientation. In Niebuhr's words, love and self-love in every soul. Now, as social and even socialist a thinker as Niebuhr imagined himself to be, this interiorized brand of Augustinianism undercut the ecclesiological basis of political theology and served to sanctify the common sense of the policy elites that Niebuhr both courted and inspired. Niebuhr's thought, in short, provides new material for the Christian Republican canopy, but it does nothing to dismantle it. As liberal and even modernist the Protestant as Reinhold remained, this reconfiguration of Augustine represents the persistence rather than the transcendence of Christian Republicanism. As in all other ways, H. Richard is a far more subtle, erudite, and intriguing thinker than his elder brother, and his appropriation of Augustine for Protestant theology is a case in point. I refer specifically to the penultimate chapter of Christ and Culture, a book much and unfairly maligned by Stanley Hauerwas and company. In that chapter, Christ, the Transformer of Culture, Little Richard employs Augustine as a prototype of the sort of revitalized social gospel to which he always remained committed. Precisely because Richard's Augustine is not a theologian of paradox, that is, political and imaginative paralysis, draped in the rhetoric of tragedy and responsibility, always two words to run to the hills from. Richard's Protestantism retained a critical edge toward those American economic and imperial institutions to which Reinhold's Augustine could only be resigned. And it acquired a political edge insofar as Richard articulated an ecclesiology, which, if not Puritan or Roman Catholic in its scope, nonetheless suggested that all human conduct belonged under some sort of ecclesiological canopy, one that had no place for the often dangerous banalities of common sense. Such a canopy, though, would not be Christian Republican, and its God would not be American. Riven by its own contradictions and compromises, the canopy of antebellum Protestant theology could not hold, which is why, in the end, Nall has traced the history of a glorious but inexorable failure. Communism was not the first, and I fear not the last, God to fail. And Mark Nall's magnificent book provides abundant evidence why.
These have been learned and charitable readings of the book, but also readings that raise interesting questions. And so we'll have you out of here by 7:45 easily. I have to settle this financial question first that Daryl brought up. Knowing that this article was forthcoming in Time magazine that it would mention America's God, I hustled up to New York City and Oxford University Press and made sure that the book was not in stock when the paper appeared and that the paperback would be still several months away. And they arranged that very nicely. And so even though I went foolishly to the Amazon.com page to check my number on America's God, despite this nice comment in Time magazine, the number for America's God sank ever deeper into the mid-sixth figures. So much for making money out of academic work. Six short, I hope, responses to what deserve a great deal more. Is this a book about American politics or about theology in America? It's a book about theology in America. Eugene McCare is too young to have read The Search for Christian America that I wrote with distinguished Westminster graduate George Marsden and distinguished incoming president of the Wake Forest University, Nathan Hatch. I'm just still a historical hack here. But it's The Search for Christian America that Eugene wants to read. The book's about the theology. But given the American circumstance of the period I was working on, in order to explain the Republican influence on Christian theology, it was necessary to explain the Christian influence on American Republicanism. And many of you were not here for the earlier session, but I would say to Carl, that here's an example of taking incarnation seriously and thinking that in order to get at the theology, you really have to work hard at the setting in which the theology, the particular context in which the theology takes place. But in my view, and what other people make of this is fine, and I'm delighted actually that other people can make things of it for the present. But believe me, George W. Bush was the last person I had in mind in writing this volume. Two, on the question of economics, Eugene's point is well taken, and I'm glad that he referenced the book God and Mammon and told you it was wonderful, because it too is an Oxford University Press that actually settles in the high seven figures in the Amazon.com list of best-selling books. That project I basically undertook as preparation for doing what I thought would be a full chapter alongside the strange confluence of evangelical religion and republicanism, evangelical religion and common sense philosophy, I really had envisioned another one, evangelical religion and market reasoning. But after working on that book, and maybe it was just because I had this long manuscript and worked on forever, needed to get it out, but I really came to the conclusion that up until the 1840s and 50s, though there is a growing and a more serious discussion by Americans on the moral and religious implications of economic matters, those discussions seem to me to be subsumed into Republican categories. And so what even people, wonderful people like Francis Wayland were doing was to talk about economic activity in terms of virtue or vice, in terms of the concentration of power and the dangers in that over-concentration. In other words, they were not doing what was happening in Britain with people like Thomas Malthus and Scottish and Anglican theologians, Thomas Chalmers and others, to really theologize about the economy. I do actually think that what Eugene refers to took place beginning in the 1850s, actually with the bank collapse of the late 50s, and would continue on, and that economic matters do enter in integrally to theology, but not until later. And so that's my effort to respond to that historical question. Third, Gene and Daryl both bring up Abraham Lincoln, and here the nature of America's God from Jonathan Edwards to Abraham Lincoln as a theological book is very important. I probably actually share the belief that Gene and Daryl both more or less expressed that you will be able to read in less than a year in what I think will be a splendid but also very controversial book by Harry Stout, A Moral History on the Civil War, in which he makes the case, I think he'll make the case, for Lincoln as a dangerous augmenter of an overweening national power. That may very well be true, but regarded theologically, Lincoln is an anomaly in the 1860s. And he's an anomaly because he does not express his theism. I don't think we say it's Christianity, but he doesn't express his theism in Enlightenment terms. American theologians, including the very good ones, knew clearly what God was doing. Abraham Lincoln says, 1862, 1865, there's a mystery in providence that we mere mortals do not know. Lincoln, unlike almost all of his contemporary theologians, was willing to suppose that he did not know the will of God and that the North also stood under the condemnation of the Lord. There's a great story that is told of women, Quaker women, I think, on a train, who are talking about who's going to win the Civil War. And the one woman says, well, it pains me to say this, but I know the South is going to win the Civil War. And the other woman says, well, why is that? Abraham is a praying man. And the other woman said, well, yes, but Jefferson Davis is a praying man, and the Lord will think that Lincoln is joking when he prays. This is a story that Lincoln told on himself, and I think it was indicative of his willingness to sit lightly to his own perception of the world and to hold firmly to divine providence as beyond the understanding, beyond the ken of human reasoners. And that theological or quasi-theological move, he was working against the Enlightenment and the commonsensical strain that had become so prominent in American theology. Which brings me then to the comments on common sense that both Jeff and Gene raised, and I think very, very appropriately, theologically considered. Jeff put it quite mildly, Eugene more strenuously, I think it was a mistake to give up Augustinian or Reformed epistemology, Augustinian Reformed anthropology, Augustinian and Reformed eventually soteriology in order to adopt common sense. However, historically considered, one has to ask, what's the alternative? Who in 19th century America had a voice, was heard, who did not adopt to one degree or another common sense. I don't think anyone can come up with an answer. Charles Carroll the Catholic did. J.W. Nevin tried to break away from common sense categories. I don't think he broke away very successfully, but whether he did or not, no one paid attention to Nevin. Nevin is a really interesting theologian in post-World War II America and to today, and I actually think he is an interesting theologian. But he's interesting because he was so out of step with his contemporaries that he had literally made himself incomprehensible. Part of it was his inability to translate German right, which is a problem a lot of us have. But more of it was taking on a conceptual vocabulary that simply could not communicate. And someone like Nevin, when push came to shove, when he came to interpret the Civil War, he was as commonsensical and as filled with enlightenment confidence that he could explain the ways of God to the world as those who had remained, who had not taken his path to return to European models. Jeff raises the point about Hodge and Warfield. I think these two theologians were as good theologians as it was possible to be in 19th century America, as positive theologians, even though I think the earlier pages of Hodge's systematic theology were juvenile, puerile, and have been the cause of Hodge not being respected the way he should be in the 20th century. The bit about theology is to the Christian as the natural world is to the scientist is just hopeless. It just doesn't compute. Warfield's failure to understand what Kuyper and the Kuyper's associates were trying to do in repositioning the place of apologetics was a defect in what I consider a very important theologian making very important statements about God and the world at the end of the 19th century and the start of the 20th century. The fact that Westminster Seminary moved away from, in its founding and to this day, the common sense of Hodge and Warfield without ever really admitting that they were doing it and trying to keep Hodge and Warfield fully on board as the progenitors of Westminster Seminary, I think reflects the respect that Hodge and Warfield deserve, and yet the nervousness about these, what I would call slight and fairly inconsequential epistemological moves that they made. But they did make them, and because they made them, then Jeff's second question about what is a person convinced that the Bible points in Augustinian Reformed directions to do in a modern, in a contemporary situation where modern, postmodern, premodern all seem to be mixed up. Declension in theology in relationship to systems of political governance. All I think I want to say here is that if you'd like to get into the discussion that Daryl raised, read for the British situation the works of J.C. D. Clarke, who makes a really strong case that monarchy is, in fact, closer to the will of God than republicanism. And then read the forthcoming book by Eugene Genovese and Elizabeth Fox Genovese called The Mind of the Masterclass. Now, this book is going to come in at about 800 or 900 pages, so don't take it to the beach and don't expect to read it when it first appears in the night. Don't stay up all night reading this book because it'll be many, many nights. Their argument is, I think, that democratic liberalism is, in fact, incompatible with Orthodox Christianity, and that something like a historic traditional patriarchal communalism is a political system more attuned to the Christian faith. So like a coward, Daryl, I'll just point you to these terrific historians and say, keep reading, start reading. And now the last point, and saving the Presbyterian best for last, is Daryl's very, I think, important comment about the changes made in the American Westminster Confession of Faith in 1787. He suggests that Presbyterians could change their polity, they could change their politics, they could change their political philosophy, and it did not affect their Calvinism, even to the extent of double predestination. Maybe. But within 35 years of this change, there is a major party in the Presbyterian Church, the old school, accusing the other major party, the new school, of in effect Americanizing Calvinist theology. The old school sort of wins that discussion, but while the old school and the new school are arguing about whether the new school has Americanized American theology, the Presbyterians are marginalized by the Methodists and the Baptists in American political life, American ecclesiastical life, and soon they'll be marginalized even more by the Catholics. And then once the kerfluffle over the Civil War is over and the new school and the old school in the North return to one denomination, it's only one more generation until the main Northern Presbyterian Church amends the Westminster Confession to include a statement about the universal offer of the gospel. Now, I believe in my denomination, the Evangelical Presbyterian Church uses the revisions of 1900 and includes the plank on the universal offer of the gospel. But this is an Americanizing step that the main Northern Presbyterian Church took. Now, Darrell could say, well, it took 100 years, but it does seem to me that you could argue that this little noticed, and I think that's exactly right, but this little noticed amendment in the Westminster Confession should be noticed, should be discussed, should be contemplated as perhaps significant. And while I don't want to insist upon what I've given you just here because it's very much off the cuff, I think a case could be made that for Presbyterian theological history in America, that unnoticed amendment has proven very important indeed. Well, this is too much and too little in response. I thank the commentators once again for charitable and kind, and most of all, for provocative readings of the book.
Dr. Noel,
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Tim Coyle, and I'm a PhD student here at Westminster. I believe it was Dr. Hart that said that in America's God, you seem to see Reformed theology as not furthering liberty, but in fact, opposed to it, and he cited in particular John Calvin and the Puritans. And Darrell, if I'm misinterpreting what you said, please correct me. But if we look at Calvin, for instance, in the Institutes, where he writes, he's got several chapters on specifically Christian liberty, and then at the very end of the book, a chapter on civil government, which originally in the first edition, the Institutes was followed directly after the chapter on Christian liberty. He talks a lot about liberty. And many of the Puritans, both in England and in New England, also talk to quite an extent about liberty. If we look at them in the context of their own time, taking steps forward, really, with regard to liberty, not from our standpoint, but from the context of their own time, are we being somewhat unfair with Calvin and the Puritans?
I'm with experts on these peoples, but so I'll just spill my ignorance and let them clean it up. No, I actually don't think we are. I found Isaiah Berlin's discussion of two kinds of liberty very important, one being negative liberty, freedom from constraint, positive liberty, the freedom to do what you wanted to do. I think the Puritans and Calvin were mostly talking about positive liberty. The liberty they found in Christ was the liberty to do what Christ made possible by his grace. If you're a Roman Catholic in Geneva, you have no liberty. If you're a Quaker in Puritan New England, you have the liberty to keep silent, but not the liberty to speak or to act. If you're a Baptist in New England, up until the 1720s, you have no liberty. Now, I would agree with your point. There are certain pronouncements made by Calvin and the Reformed tradition more generally that later generations were actually able to build upon to move toward negative liberty, getting government and the church out of the minute control of individual lives. But I think the early Protestant reformers were really serious about reforming Christendom. Only the Anabaptists wanted to get rid of Christendom, and then only in the 18th century and really even the 19th century and maybe even the 20th century, did the magisterial Protestant traditions concede that their mandate was not to shape all of society for the glory of Christ?
If I can just add, I think particularly in the illustration you use of Geneva, more recently it seems that there is also the aspect of not just ordering a Christian society, but specifically the issue of pastoral care individuals.
Right.
And that becomes a much more specific ecclesiastical emphasis in Geneva particularly.
I do think that to be said for Geneva and the Puritans, they did want to see the church liberated from the overweening hand of the state. And this, I think, really is a positive development. And it's why, although students laugh, I say that when Calvin turned, or the church court in Geneva, turned Servetus over to the state for execution, that was actually a very significant matter, as was also Calvin's plea that Servetus be executed by beheading rather than burning. If I was going to be executed, I'd want to be beheaded rather than burned to the stake. That seemed to be a charitable and a humane gesture. But students, for some reason, don't get it and don't see that the Servetus affair actually speaks to the wave of the future. But it is a wave of the future. But it's a wave of the future only in the limited sense that the Reformed sense of the church was trying to be liberated from the overweening control of the state.
Yeah, I would just add as well to that, there is a, certainly prior to 1700, certainly prior to 1600, there is a strong Reformed soteriological consensus across Europe that cuts across all kinds of boundaries on church government. For example, first decade of the 17th century, the English Erastians are very reformed in terms of their theological understanding, but very strongly in favor of an Erastian church. Then I think if you took the story up to the 1630s and 1640s, and you read people like George Gillespie or Robert Bailey, Samuel Rutherford, the language of liberty is everywhere, but it's liberty of the church from the state in terms of interference. Gillespie, Rutherford, Bailey, they wanted Baptists put in prison. They may have wanted it done out of love, but Baptists, Quakers, fanatics, they would have put these men in prison. And that's what's so ironic, I think, about it, say, the Rutherford Institute today that is campaigning for religious freedom, and I think has taken on law cases to allow for the reading of the Quran in state schools. Samuel Rutherford would die a thousand deaths if he wasn't dead already to know that his name was being used in such a context. So I think the language of liberty, it's there, but the mere use of the word and its cognates has to be put very carefully in context, and readings from the 20th, 19th century not read back into it too quickly.
I find it interesting that all of your comments and all of Dr. Knoll's comments focus on religious liberty, but Calvin and the Puritans were also writing on political liberty too. And that my thinking was addressed more along those lines. And I'm not ignoring the element of religious liberty, but when we're talking about liberty from the pen of these guys, I think we have to recognize there was more going on than just religious liberty.
I disagree emphatically with that. I do not think these men are capable of making the conceptual distinction that is necessary to be made to make a distinction between political liberty and religious liberty in the 16th, 17th century.
I don't know that we need a distinction. I'm just saying that I think they were doing both.
Well, in favor of what you're saying, we have Cromwellian England, which is in some measures a freer place. If you're Jewish, it's better to be under Cromwell than the monarchs coming sooner or later. Puritan New England has a broader franchise, in that sense a more freer franchise than anywhere in the world. But this is still a unitary ideal of a unitary polity, and the ideal is for the instruments of the state to glorify God as well as the instruments of the church.
I certainly think by the time you reach the 1640s, 1650s, the picture is changing. My comments are really sort of pre-1645, essentially.
I'm Rob Gagnon. I've come 100 miles from Central Presbyterian Church in Summit, New Jersey. I'm a little late in life here, but I'm thinking of a seminary. I've come to that conclusion because I know I can probably do it better from what I've seen. Eugene, if I can call you by your first name, no personal problems here, except that you might have been happier if the English didn't subjugate the Irish and somehow Spain and France squeezed out the 13 original colonies. My feeling is that people had to have a British Civil War for Parliament, the French Revolution, the Spanish Civil War. I'm not saying this, what you're saying, this Christian republicanism is maybe perfect, but the other disaster, I don't think it's tolerable. And the last concept, I'm not belittling anybody here. I mean, I'm just telling you what's going on. I was raised a Roman Catholic. Most of my relatives are still Catholic. They have yet to get over the idea of the little boys being touched by the priest and basically this theocracy, autocratic sort of government, sort of switching people around. So I guess my question is, both sides have their problems, but it seems to me some sense of common sense, individual freedoms or something, is a lot better than what's been going on recently. And I sure as heck wouldn't want to move to Utah unless I was a Mormon. So I don't know, Eugene, am I being too mean to you? I mean, what I'm trying to say is that there's a theocracy in Utah, that's all. I mean, you seem to be for people who are totally in charge and there's an authority figure and somebody knows best or something. Did I miss all that? Or?
Could you sharpen the question?
Well, the question is basically, how can you still believe after all of this that somehow a few people in charge is better than the common sense approach? That's all.
I'm not aware that I do believe that a few people should be in charge.
I thought that was...
I don't understand that comment at all.
I thought that's what Roman Catholicism was, sir. Maybe I misunderstood.
I think you do. But this is not the place for me to parse ecclesiology. When I'm talking about common sense, I mean, I'm talking about common sense in a very ideological way. The way in which I think anybody, when they hear the words pragmatic or practical, should always ask pragmatic or practical in terms of what? I mean, somebody who simply says that something is practical is saying precisely nothing. Just as when somebody uses the phrase common sense, my first question is, whose community? I mean, it was quite commonsensical for Nazis to gas Jews. Made perfect sense to them. I mean, and this is I think, what you know, something that might speak to the question that was raised in the first session about evil. Evil is one of the things that I think is has to be remembered about evil is that evil comes often in very, very friendly and beguiling faces, and one of them is common sense. I mean, I think that has to be remembered. So, you know, when I hear the word common sense, my reaction is head for the hills.
Daryl Hall has indicated he'd like to respond to that.
Well, I hate to be thought of as an advocate for Rome. I am as suspicious of that kind of concentrated power as any good Christian Republican. But I would be remiss if I didn't point out, and this is a plug for the Intercollegiate Studies Institute where I now work, that it's an amazing thing, and Gene may not agree with some of the Roman Catholics that work with me down at ISI, but it's an amazing thing that since 1960, Roman Catholics have been bigger defenders of liberty, ordered liberty especially, than most Protestants, whether evangelical or mainline. And the sort of prediction that Abraham Kuyper made in his lectures at Princeton in 1898, roughly, about Protestantism prospering and Catholicism on decline did in no way envision the remarkable turn, it's in my estimation, as far as Catholic-Protestant relations and defending the West and ordered liberty in America. And if you, you know, again, Gene may not be happy with this political lineage, but some of the great conservatives and neoconservatives, Buckley, Kirk, et cetera, were Roman Catholics. So it's a remarkable thing that a church that's known for being so hierarchical can turn out to defend something as democratic and liberal as the West and especially the American embodiment of it. So it's something to keep in mind. I don't know if you wanted to.
I actually want to move in just the other direction and do say some good things about common sense as it came to be used as both a philosophical and a more common sense seat of the pants notion in the 18th, early 19th century. What Americans faced were a competitive and incommensurate visions of comprehensive society. So there was a Puritan congregational vision. There was a kind of watered down Anglican vision. There certainly was a Scottish Presbyterian vision, but the Scottish Presbyterian migrants to America couldn't begin to implement it in any wide territory because they came to the colonies that had already been settled or to sparsely settled areas. Common sense was an effort to bridge some of these incompatible differences, and yet to say that God had made possible the ability of Christian people, because that's all they were thinking about, Christian people to communicate with each other. Now, the hidden costs were really high, and on the hidden cost, I think I would agree with what both Gene and Jeff had to say. But again, what else was possible? Jonathan Edwards could have done what he did in the mid-1740s to restrict church membership and say, and I don't care who's the governor of Massachusetts. But no one would have understood that. No, they would have thought Edwards was pagan. He could have said, we no longer want to criticize merchants in the Connecticut River Valley when they are too aggressive in their aggrandizing wealth. No Puritan would have understood that. So he was, I think, making the way for an adaptation of Puritanism that the next generation, the John Witherspoons of the world, felt was a Christian way of making just a small adjustment in order to preserve the benefits of Western Christian civilization. In that sense, common sense was more persuasive than forcing everybody to be a Presbyterian or a Congregationalist or an Anglican. Over the course of time, I think we can see the real problems with that move theologically. But in the late 18th century, it doesn't seem to me that there was much of an option.
Jeff, can I follow up and ask then, in terms of options then, these Edwards is heavily dependent on von Maastricht, and you can see the theological genealogies of so many in the 18th century. They were reading these things much better than us. And how would they view then a number of their theological shifts? Would they recognize that they were actually moving away from the 17th century when they are so heavily dependent in other areas and other issues of theology upon the 17th century? How is it that there are no other options? Would they have noticed that?
I mean, in some sense, Jeff's question is just what Daryl was really forcing me to think about in terms of the 1787 revision of the Westminster Confession. None of us are thinking machines. None of us are well put together people. People, individuals like Edwards are better put together intellectually, but Edwards is not God, and no thinker is. As a historian, one of the reasons I really like Quentin Skinner, whom Carl referenced in the earlier hour, is that in working with political history, he proposed historical means that anybody could do to track patterns over time, and especially to track how the introduction of a particular kind of vocabulary to deal with one narrow political problem can spread to influence, in fact, shape the rest of the political system. That way of doing political history seemed to me to work wonderfully for theological history, because with a person like Edwards, the last thing he wants is for his followers to stop reading von Maastricht, which they all do by the time even of his death. But he's finite. He's making the best choice he knows under God, and yet the world's contingent. When things happen, there are consequences. Sometimes you know what they are, and sometimes you don't.
And do you think then that after the dust has sort of settled by the 19th century, that then the debates between Warfield and Kuyper now are so firmly grounded in the history of that common sense influence, that that's what keeps the discussion from Kuyper and Warfield moving ahead?
Yes, I do. I mean, some of you have read Warfield's very charitable, kind, and emphatically positive review of Kuyper's, I believe, Sacred Theology. He said this is a wonderful, wonderful work, but there's one problem. Kuyper just launches into his theology. He doesn't have a long prolegomena justifying the existence of God. I just don't understand, Warfield says. It's incomprehensible to me. And this is a very bright guy. It's incomprehensible to me how he can do that. And I can only account for that expression of incomprehensibility by looking at the century and a half of history that's gone before in the Netherlands and in America.